Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Showcase new authors. This is show number 142, and it is August 7th, 2023. I am your host, Tom Riddell, and co-host Terry Brown will be with us shortly. And a little brief intro to today's show. We have back on George O'Brien, who wrote Night Mountain, and he will be with us shortly at about 15 minutes past the hour, wherever you are. Now, more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge or find us easily on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we will get back to you. Special note, we can now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and A Readsy Discovery. They do both do a great job to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on August 21st, 2 weeks from tonight, Chris Gould will be back with us with his new book, The Boys and Girls of America. Experience what it was like in the 1990s for a writer to return to a school as a writer in residence, even though he was refused entry when he applied in 1985. On September 4th, 2023, PJ Murphy will be here with Dead Letters. That's his new book. Best-selling author Richard Debson is missing. The only clue, a copy of his unpublished final novel delivered to his ex-girlfriend, Amy. At his memorial, Amy and Chris, Richard's best friend, work to uncover the mystery. Could Richard still be alive? tune in. Maybe you'll find out. That would be on September 4th of 2023. We're moving right along here. And a special note for tonight, and I'm very excited to announce that this is our 12th anniversary of the Writer's Lounge. And through the years, with a few years off, we have done an awful lot and seen an awful lot, talked to an awful lot of people, and I'm very proud of the accomplishments of all the authors out there. And, of course, my co-hosts have helped me along the way with this adventure, too. And it has been an adventure, and I'm very happy to say we're here for 12, and I hope we're going to be here for a lot more. But now let's get on to our next segment, and that would be Writer's Topics. And this is where I introduce my fabulous co-host, Terry Brown, and I open up the magic door. There used to be a show called the Magic Toy Shop. You open up the magic door to the magic toy shop, and then through that magic door comes all the kids sitting down. Well, we've got a co-author, she is an author, but she's my co-host, and it's Terry Brown. And how are you doing, Terry?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, except right now we're in the midst of a storm. So if we lose power and we go out, I'm going to have to inform you and George that we're going to have to come back at a later time, hopefully, within the next couple of days or maybe next week. But hopefully that won't happen. And I heard you're dealing with storms down there in North Carolina. Is that correct?
Yeah, right now, at the moment, we're fine, but they're expecting a big one to come through here tonight around 9 o'clock. Big warnings and high wind and all kinds of stuff. So
yeah, before we go off, or, hopefully it comes before we or after we go off the air, but hopefully it isn't too bad for you. I know that tornadoes are in the forecast in some areas, and most of the East Coast, I believe, and South, have already dealt with a lot of those storms today. So everybody out there, if you're listening, heed the warnings and take cover. Brought to you by the Writer's Lounge. We don't usually do weather forecasts, but
report from the Writer's Lounge.
Right. You could be listening to the show maybe 12 months from now and think I'm an idiot, but, probably in the middle of winter when it's storming. But anyways, you had mentioned, and I was interested in hearing about the Writer's Topic for tonight, which would be Furious Fiction. And I want to say that when I read that on your Facebook page, I immediately was reminded of a book that I have. I'm holding it right now in my hands. It's about, maybe 200 pages in length. But it's called Write the Story, and some of the topics here would be the year 2563, Haunted House, Encounter at Sea. And what it does is it gives you these stories that you have to write. You only get about one page, and I believe probably around 500 words, and some of the words that you have to use were some of the titles of these stories. The first one would be A Strange Request at a Piano Bar. And you have to use the words carnival, apple, sprained, juvenile, mask, twirl, and awkward. And so you have to include all those words in the story, and it's quite a challenge to do that. And I found it very entertaining to write some of these stories that I've already written in this book, and very, very challenging to do this. And I'm wondering, Terry, with your Furious Fiction, how are you doing with that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Furious Fiction is something that the Australian Writers' Center puts out. They give you 55 hours, so they put it out on a Friday, but it's Australian time, so I always have less than 55 hours because they put it out in the middle of the night for me. And then they give you usually a location or where they need the story to start. And then they give you three totally unrelated words, and you have to write a flash fiction story. Flash fiction is, for those who don't know, it's shorter than a short story. It's typically 1,000 words or less, And then different places will have flash fiction at different lengths. So for Furious Fiction, it has to be 500 words or less. I do one that has to be under 50 words. I do another one that has to be exactly 53 words. So it's really interesting to try to write within those very tight parameters. For instance, the Furious Fiction that just passed this past weekend was, it has to be less than 500 words. It had to happen in a restaurant, and it had to include the words euphoria, silhouette, and labyrinth. And so then you just have to start writing. Yeah, it's like what comes to mind? What, you know, what's there? And the one that I'm doing that's three, I think it's called 53 Prime, and it's 53 words exactly. This month's has to be about the search. This one's a little easier in terms of they don't give you words that you have to use, but it has to be exactly 53 words, not less than 53, exactly 53. So that's a little harder because, you know, you get your story written and then you realize that maybe you're at 57 and then I have to figure out which four words to go. Or can you rewrite a sentence in a way that you've gotten rid of a word? Or what if you're at 51 words? Now, where are you going to add and which words are you going to pick? Because you don't want to just make any 53 words. It's trying to make the best 53 words. So, you know, is it ever going to make anyone famous or a lot of money? Probably not. But I think it's a really good tool to kind of teach yourself how to write within certain parameters and how to, you know, how to keep it brief and how to tell a story in a short amount of time and how to create a twist and all of those things. I just really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
What I like about it, too, is that it also gives you the opportunity, if you want to revisit it in the future and maybe expand on it and turn it into a full-length novel.
Exactly.
You know, if the theme is there and you really like it, why not stretch it out? Why not make it into a novel? And that's why I keep going back every now and then to this book that I have, Write the Story, and I look at these short stories that I've written and wonder, you know, can I turn it into a novel? So it's there. I think
right,
it benefits
right. And
a writer.
You know,
yes.
Did you create a character? You know, like is there a character there that
yes.
maybe it isn't that story, but that character keeps coming back to you? And so you think, well, what could I do with that character? Could I incorporate this piece into something because of this character? I think it's also a really good way, especially if you're feeling a little bit blocked. You
yes.
know, like you don't know what you're supposed to write. Like, I just feel kind of like I don't know where I'm going from here. To kind of have this, you have 55 hours. You have to write 500 words. It has to be in a restaurant with these three words, go. It gives your mind a focus point. And then even if you don't come up with anything that's fantastic, you've been thinking about writing and doing some writing and flipping words around in your head. And I think it kind of helps move that blockage along so that it isn't quite so profound.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, it would be very good for writer's block, and I think all of us run into that from time to time, especially if we're engaged in a story and deep in a story. I just am coming to the end of writing a story that I've been working on for a number of years now, and it's only, I think, 30,000 words. It's not too long. But sometimes you have to disengage, and you have to get out of it, get into something else. And then when you come back, sometimes what you find out is you're right back into the story again, because it does. It really wears on your brain to stay in the story for a long period of time. It's almost like, I don't know, when I try to disengage from my writing today, I'm walking around the house thinking I'm still in the story and I've got things to do in the house. That kind of helps you get out into these other little smaller stories and work on them. Anyways, let's get on to the next segment, and that would be guest author intro and interview. And, of course, George O'Brien will be here shortly with Night Mountain. And I want to remind everybody out there, if you were listening live. Don't be shy. We don't bite. George, me, and Terry, we're here to comfort you and help you with that phobia you might have. And our number is area code 914-219-0868. And my review of Night Mountain, the year was 1250. In the wilderness lands of what would eventually be modern-day western Alabama, there lived an Indian clan. They were the Cherotu people. They were a predominantly peaceful people living off the land, harvesting corn and other crops and trying to build their community, but there was a neighboring tribe that wanted war with the Cherotu people. Night Mountain, a young man from the Cherotu tribe and his family, including his wife, were ambushed by the Apalamo warriors. After the attacks, Night Mountain made valiant attempts to rally his clan against the Apalama tribe, but the future battles would prove to be devastatingly deadly to his people. When Night Mountain's people conquer the Apalama and endure the hardships and survive as a people, we learn about their lives and their fate through oral historians like Thunder Rock, who was known as Trail Talker. He begins by saying, "I guide my people to the future by showing them the way they came. I believe there is a lack of knowledge and understanding about Native Americans and a greater lack of focus on what the geology of this land we call America was like before the Europeans settled this continent. This is what drew my interest to this novel. It's the first of the Trail Talker trilogy, and I look forward to reading more." For me, the novel started off with a little too much narrative and not enough dialogue because I wanted to know more about the characters from their point of view. But soon, as the story began to unfold, I was totally immersed in the tale and literally could not put the book down. The author's descriptive ability, especially during action scenes, had me gripping the arm of my chair, and he is equally adept at evoking emotions, causing me to care a great deal about his characters. George O'Brien has successfully delivered in this first installment of the trilogy, and it's easy to see why I and others are excited to want more from this very talented author. I loved Night Mountain, and now it is our pleasure to welcome George O'Brien to the Writer's Lounge, and we will open the magic door and let George wander in here. And there's George. Hey, George, you look pretty good there. How are you?
Yeah, well, I'm wandering all right.
You're wandering. Okay. Wandering through the same wilderness as Night Mountain is probably wandering.
Probably.
And George,
I was listening to your exercise that Terry was talking about. My daughter, my middle child, Christine, is also an author. She wrote a sort of a self-help book called Deal With It, Doll. But in Dallas, there's a group called the Writers Garret, and they do a poem. It has to be 30 lines and include 30 particular words. So it sounded a bit like some of the exploratory stuff that Terry was talking about, and ways you can, you know, play with wordsmithing and just get out of your daily routine of trying to come up with brilliant new ideas, you know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
I like all of those.
There are a lot of contests out there like that, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try one.
Yep, you should, George. So anyway, you were here before with us, I don't know, a couple of years ago or whatever, regarding
That's
another
That's a secret, though.
Author.
We can't say.
I'm biting my tongue on that. We're not going to mention the person's name. But anyways, George, tell us about yourself. When did you catch the writer's bug, and why did you decide to write Night Mountain and eventually the trilogy?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, thank you for letting me get back here again and to meet Terry via long distance. The other book that Tom's alluding to was written under a pseudonym with a friend, and it's an entirely different genre. It's sort of not appropriate for this tonight anyway. Well, this is a very strange story in the regard that I started writing Night Mountain in 1995 and published it in 2021. In the middle of COVID, and used COVID as a way of getting over the hump with Night Mountain and Thunder Rock. I started writing, and let me explain a little bit about my background. Right now I'm sitting in a suburb of Boston. My wife and I come up here for the summer and the fall, and we stay with a relative. And we spend 6 months in Dallas there with my daughter, and we spend the winter and spring there. So I have a lot of roots in Massachusetts. I went to college here. I went to grad school here. I took an out-of-town assignment, 94 to 96, as a chief financial officer of a company that was struggling. And my family was in Dallas at the time. And so I just sat down at night and had tired of watching TV every night. So I just started writing. When you ask me why I wrote about the particular tribes and clans that I did, I can't tell you why I did that. I have a sister that was born on another planet in a spaceship far, far away, and she would tell you that it's a past life experience or something. I don't think that's what it was. It was probably a paragraph somewhere, maybe a National Geographic article. Not quite sure. And I started writing about Native Americans in Western Alabama. And as I did research, I found out there was a famous site there called Moundville, which is a very large earthen mounds and a whole, in effect, small city of that, a large, large village. So as I did some research, I said, well, I've sort of gotten lucky. And I kept writing. And after about another year of that, I changed jobs, moved back to Dallas, had a couple of life changes, divorce, remarried, bunch of grandkids, a couple of job changes. And I plugged away and plugged away. And I finally got this giant 160,000-word book and said, what the hell am I going to do with it? So I broke into two, Night and Mountain being the four-part, and Thunder Rock being 250 years later. And then when we were living in a different state, in North Carolina, as a matter of fact, I engaged with a woman that I had seen do some writing, and she was going to help me edit it. But she wasn't doing sort of line editing and proofing. She was sort of rewriting it. And I said, if I keep working with her, it won't be my story anymore. So I packed up that and then used COVID and hired a professional editor, did the cover and all that kind of good stuff, and published both of those books kind of back-to-back in the spring of 2021. Started working on the third book in the trilogy, which is fits in the time frame in between. So that's sort of a bunch of it. I could get back to something more specific if I didn't get all your questions answered there, Tom.
Very good. You did very good, George. And I was going to tell you that we just had another connection here. I often talk to Terry about teaming her up with people she can become friends with, but you didn't mention North Carolina. So I thought, well, there's another little catch there. Terry, we hooked you up again.
We're going to start calling this the Writer's Lounge, where Terry makes friends.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, Terry, we built a house in St. James Plantation near Wilmington.
Oh my gosh, that's the same county I live in.
There you go.
Yeah, you live in Calabash, right?
Yeah, I live in Calabash. I live in the Brunswick Plantation.
Right. Well, we moved there in 2012, stayed there through 2017, but never got to see the grandchildren very often. So we said, if you can't beat them, join them. So we have one granddaughter here in Massachusetts. One daughter has two in Dallas. The other daughter has one. And then when we transit the country by car, we see my son in the Maryland area. He's got two. And Paula's son is out in Colorado. We don't get to see him as often because he was in San Diego. Now he's in Colorado. But so we're spread out all over the place. But
how
really
crazy is that, that you lived in the – I mean, as big as North Carolina is, you and I both live in the same place. That's just crazy.
Oh, yeah, I mean, a half hour drive away, yeah.
Yes,
yep.
That's right,
yep.
And there we go. There we go. We did it again. It's certainly and literally a very small world. But, George, I can only guess the amount of research that went into writing this trilogy. Can you – tell us more about that, and were there any challenges that you had with presenting, for instance, languages and customs and the geology of the land back then?
Well, a couple of things. When I started writing it in 95 and 96 when I was in Massachusetts, I didn't have access to MIT or Harvard Library or any of those things. And so I did what research I could, and then over time began to buy books, and I amassed sort of 24 books on the subject. But let me say this. If you were going to describe this book as historical fiction, I would say it with a very small H and a very large F. Okay?
Right. Okay.
There were a couple of writers out there, the Gears William and his wife, that have wrote a bunch of Paleo-Indian books and then later started to write about pre-contact, you know, before the Spanish came books. And some of those are sort of overlaid on mine. I've made myself not read them. I read one of their Paleo books. So I'm not an anthropologist. I don't pretend to be. And so I'll give you an example. I made up the name Cherotu and I made up the name Aplanoma. And now knowing that Aplanoma wasn't going to last very long, I wasn't worried about it. But what I do in the second book is I morph the Cherotu, which is sort of a kind of a twisted combination of Cherokee and Choctaw. And then the later folks are Creek Indians, which are, you know, real tribes from that area. So I figured back in 1250, I'm not sure anybody really understood
right.
what tribes they were. I did visit
right.
Brownville. Right. One of the things that I did was I was doing a map of the book, and then later the follow-up book where a Spanish sailor travels eventually through Florida to Georgia. And when you look at modern-day maps, they bear no relationship to what was there before. There were no reservoirs in Alabama. So rivers and lakes and things like that have changed. But we drove that. We've driven the Natchez Trace. We've been to Manville, spent a couple of days at Manville, and absorbed what we could and, you know, done as much reading as we could on the subject. The second book, Thunder Rock, which occurs in 1540, and as Tom said, the connection is this oral historian. Thunder Rock is the trail talker. He's the oral historian. He lives in the 1500s. But in the first book, he, almost like a flashback, he's telling stories to young children about the history of their tribe, and particularly this Night Mountain and the conflicts that Tom brought up with battling off the Aplanoma and then some other stuff. So that's the connection. He's the title character of the second book, and it's also the name of a place for which he's named. And then I had, in the second book, I have a Spanish gentleman who's shipwrecked near St. Augustine in Florida. And then he eventually travels into the hegemony of the Pensacola and the Cherokee. It's a bit of an amalgam in that regard. The third book, which fits in between time, is a little harder for me because I decided it was going to fit in between. It wasn't going to be a post-Spanish story. It was going to be in between. The first book ends with Night Mountain leaving to some tragedies, and the second book starts with a relative of his 10 generations later coming back with signs that he knew where he was. And anyway, so I'm writing about Mexico in the 1250 to 1500 period, and so that's a whole new kind of research. And I might add
very good.
To use something like ChatGPT to do a little research organization for me, because I can do a lot of research, but it's nice if you can just say, describe this particular place, and it'll type out a Word document for you, you know?
Yeah, as you get closer to modern times.
Do you enjoy the historical research, or do you find it to be just a chore that you have to do in order to write?
I think in terms of the Alabama-Florida thing, I did enough that I was trying not to completely tread on the truth, okay? And
right.
I tried to create a fictional story that, as Tom described, at some point gets engaging. I was a bit of a rookie writer, and I did a little too much, you know, show, not tell. And tell, not show. And so this time I'm trying to be a little bit better at it. The hard part about the second one, these two books are easy. They're sort of over one person's lifespan. And but the other one is over 250-year period, so I've decided to divide that into basically four sections of sort of 60 years, maybe the maximum lifetime of a family, or, you know, the mother or the father of a family, and then how those families sort of connect over the 250-year period, and one of them wanders back with a series of traders going around the Gulf of Mexico. But the research itself, you know, like the Gears, as I said, were the anthropologists. I can't do that. I can't out-anthropology them. I've read books by the University of Alabama, which has a bunch of that stuff in there, but decided to take a little bit of literary license in terms of that. And really just said, how would people, although they think differently about Earth and they think differently about where they came from and they had different languages, how would they react to stresses in their life? Get attacked by another tribe. Wife is carried away in a tornado. Grandfather has a heart attack, yada, yada, yada. So I tried to say, what would happen in real world things people had to react to?
Right.
Yep. That's really interesting because I know Terry is finished with the book that you're writing about your Native American. There's a Native American
yes.
theme in your book. So,
right.
you know, as far
right.
as research, did you, Terry, get bogged down or did you kind of just free flow with the whole thing? Did you do a lot of research or what?
I did a general overall understanding in a few places. I delved deep so that I could get some good accurate facts. But mostly I think I do what George is doing, which is that idea of I'm character driven far more than I am place driven when I'm writing. So even though my characters are older and they may be different cultures, they still have human emotion. And that's where I focus a
right.
lot of my attention. And then I just try to have kind of an accurate background. And as long as it's accurate, most people don't want to know the MIT version of a tribe or whatever. They just want a couple of facts that help
right.
them kind of connect in the story. So.
Right. I didn't even know
yeah.
that these tribes, George, existed, and I didn't even look it up. I just assumed they did, but it doesn't really matter if they existed or not because you, again, go back to the 1250, and, you know, I mean, you know, going back that far, you really kind of get lost. But that's why your
right.
story stood out to me. And Terry, go ahead with the next question. Did we lose Terry?
Well, we lost her for a second.
Okay. Maybe she'll come back. But anyway, how did the characters evolve in your imagination? And we were talking a little bit off the air earlier, George, about a T-shirt
yeah.
that we both bought. We found out we both bought the
right.
T-shirt where they talked to you. But how did you get them down on paper, and why did you pick them specifically instead of others in the tribe?
Well... I had this notion that there were these two peaceful clans as part of a larger tribe. The Night Mountain and Summer Dove is his young wife. And so I have them traveling from his village to her village because she's pregnant. But I wanted to start out with relationship building between the two chieftains because it was a very peaceful area. And it was because there were a bunch of sort of wise chiefs that weren't selfish. And they want to sort of lean on each other. And they weren't warlike, although they, if necessary, they could become so. And then I just wanted to create some conflict, and somehow I began to talk about them traveling from one village to the next to announce her pregnancy to her family. And I had this idea of, will they get ambushed on the riverbank, you know, and what would happen later? And, of course, a couple of them escaped, but not many. And began to do that. And as you go through it, you say, well, who's going to live through this? And I had this guy Windrunner live through it. And later he becomes a major character and actually a chief in the tribe. So I just played with that. In the second book, I get a little more farther afield. But, I want to do other stuff. I've been, as a young child, had an out-of-body experience. So here's the stuff that I found interesting about writing. There are sometimes, as you all described, you struggle and you can't put pen to paper and make any sense of it. And other times you can see a movie in your head and you write that movie, so to speak. And then there are other times when you're writing that movie that the characters take you along. So, for example, early in the book when the grandfather, who's a sort of retired chief, if you will, an elder, is talking to his good friend, who's an old warrior, about how peaceful things have been, and he's a little nervous about that. And just then is when the ambush is occurring, and he's, you know, 30, 50 miles away. He has a heart attack. And while he's having a – and I did not plan that chapter. He and his friend were just going to walk through the cornfields, and have a chat with the farmers and thank them for all their good work and ask what they were doing. And I decided on something and then later found out it was a symbol. I had a hawk come in and snatch some mice from the cornfields and found out that was sort of considered a war symbol. I may have written that in after I knew that what the war symbol was. But at that point, the older gentleman, the warrior, who's never been afraid of anybody in his whole life, is holding onto his friend's shoulder while the old man is having a heart attack, and he gets so upset that he has his out-of-body experience, and he feels like he's floating away, like the hawk watching what's going down. He could see his body, and he could see his friend's body. So I played with some phantasm, if you will, you know, although it's real world, it happens to people, and just to see if that would add depth to what they were, the characters.
That's what I like the most about writing is the development of the character, and then once you develop that, they kind of take over the story, and sometimes they just kind of pull you along instead of the other way around, and I love when that happens, and I think there's some sort of a magic about that, because usually when that happens, not all the time, but usually, talking to other authors, I've talked to people offline too, but usually when that happens, it turns into a bestseller, or at least, you know, kind of in the area of maybe a bestseller. It gets, you know, maybe 25, 50, five-star reviews, and it really takes off that way. So that to me is the magic of the story, is even when I'm reviewing books, they that means an awful lot. The character development means an awful lot to the story and how much of an interest I take in the story itself. And we do have Terry back, and welcome, Terry. The tornado didn't get you, did it?
No, we have been having connectivity issues here. I don't know what – I think it's so many people have moved into the area that the towers can't handle. I could hear you. You couldn't hear me.
Right. Okay. So let's
crazy,
go with
yeah.
Terry, you get the next question.
All right. So people have often referred to the Native Americans as savages, which, of course, is, you know, definitely not correct. You pointed out in your story that they were calculating and experienced in warfare and communication with their fellow warriors. Can you give us a little bit of an example of this?
First of all, these people were, by our reckoning, primitive, but they weren't savages. And the word savage probably came from some Spanish translation from some kiss-ass monk who had no choice but to write good things about the soldiers he was with, okay?
Right,
so,
right.
Or white settlers trying to take the land from Native Americans, and, whether it was the Cherokees getting moved to Oklahoma or warfare. So I tried to deal with these people as people who were just living in a culture that is, let me use the word, more primitive, right? Doesn't have machinery. These people don't even build mounds out of stone, and they hear the stories of the Mexican pyramids. And this is why Night Mountain wants to go to Mexico at the end of book one, because he's heard about these advanced civilizations and things like that. In fact, in the second book, the character who comes back is also called Thunder Rock, by the way. It's a coincidence that's deliberate. Brings back a Mayan, an Aztec calendar stone, right? So the most advanced mathematics were achieved by them just as they were in other places like the Moors in Africa and other people. But they knew more about astronomy than the Europeans did. So I don't consider them savages. I just consider them people living in a different environment. And they had different kind of needs. They didn't, you know, just the way it was.
Right. I love how your book did that and doesn't push stereotypes. You know, a lot of people do have that stereotype in their mind, you know, savage Indians, whatnot, and that's not how you had it. You very much gave us an understanding of their culture and their civilization.
Yes, you turn them into people instead of groups.
Exactly.
Let me jump forward and switch genres for a moment. Tom has read this book that I co-authored. I just finished the sequel to that book. And without describing in too much detail, the last chapter of the book a renegade politician, let me leave it at that, is captured by an Indian tribe that lives in North Dakota, South Dakota, and they march him to turn him over to the federal authorities. And in that, I have a scene where the chief of the local tribe said, you know, we have to decide what to do. And he said, you know, when the white man came, we went to war with him and he went to war with us. And we both become more civilized and we don't kill each other anymore. But I had to go to my tribal council to decide, what do I do with this prisoner? And so the fires start by the entrance to this particular reservation, and the Indians are dancing around the fire, creates some drama. And this politician has got a hood over his head. And the chief says, well, we've decided to scalp him. And everybody goes, ooh, shock, and the crowd doesn't know what to do. And so they whip the hood off this guy, and he's already bald. They're not going to scalp him. And the Indian chief has this giant knife, but he doesn't do anything with it. He just laughs, you know. So the whole idea is, you know, they can play with human nature as much as anybody could.
Sure.
I think once you get past the Spanish arrival, the world completely changed because of the disease that they brought more than anything. So we'll never know what they would have become.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Sure. So
exactly.
This bald man, and I am bald, has a question for you, George, and it's one that kept going through my mind as I read your book, and I'm hoping you have a reasonable response to it, because it really puzzled me, and I'm hoping you give me a good answer. One question popped in my head, and that was, when I read Night Mountain, why were there no horses being used back then?
There were no horses.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know the answer to that.
There were wild horses out west that died away, where the dinosaurs died away, as far as I know it. And the horses that came to the United States later in Mexico came from when the Spanish came over, and the horses escaped. Is that fair?
What year was that?
That, I was going to say, the Spanish brought them. Yeah, so his first story is before the Spanish came, so there would be no domesticated horses.
And the Spanish bought domesticated pigs, which are continuing to overrun the country, which are now wild. They're feral boars and stuff. No,
what year was that, though?
Well, the Spanish literally came in Columbus 1492, but in the United States, De Soto in the second book is 1543, goes through Florida in the southeast, and then kind of gets chased westward. And at some point, they just escaped on the prairie. And later they were used as trade in Mexico and in California. And so they came from a couple of different places, but all from the Spanish, really.
That's remarkable. See, I learned something, Terry. It's something we do here in the Writer's Lounge, and it's something I didn't know, and I'm supposed to be somebody that's really interested in history. And I really screwed that one up, got an F on that question.
Interesting things too, when you go back and you say, okay, in 1540, what vegetables were they eating? Were they the same vegetables they're eating in 1250? You know, corn had been maize and was beginning to be cultivated. But the period of the 1200s, it depends where you are. There were a lot of drought. So there are some rumors that this part of Alabama, some of the villages got abandoned because of the drought. The times change with the weather, just like they are today.
Exactly. Okay, so there were several scenes in your book that stood out to me as some of the most intense scenes, and I truly mean this, George, most intense scenes that I've ever read in a book. Without giving too much away, there is a scene, one was a storm scene. When you write these segments, can you tell us how it eventually gets down on paper from the beginning thought process to the editing, et cetera? Can you tell us how that evolves in your head?
Again, I think it's you see a movie, I was looking for a way to create some chaos in Night Mountain's life. So I have his wife and daughter swept away in a storm, and without getting into too much detail. And then I spent some time reading about it. And then ironically, in the middle of having written part of the book but never finished it, I traveled through Alabama later to visit some relatives of my wife when tornado went through Tuscaloosa, Alabama, all through Alabama. So you're trying to visualize what that must have been like and what the storm must have been to make people fearful. And so I also try to get some of these sort of natural events in there. The Aplanoma, for example, attack the Cheruto and the Pensacola, not just out of a sense of viciousness, although they are, but because a hurricane wiped out whatever they had and poisoned the fish. So they were sort of desperate, and so try to use nature as a driving force then, because I think everything was a cycle of nature for them, whether it was the astronomers of the Aztecs and the Mayans or whether it was, you know, the everyday farmer trying to keep crows and mice out of his cornfields, you know.
Right, right. That was a white knuckle moment for me. I was literally squeezing the armchair when I was reading scene. So you did an exceptional job with that. So go back and reread it, and then take that scene and kind of bring along into another book. I would hope maybe you could, you know, continue writing those type of scenes, because that was phenomenal. You would probably get probably an Oscar if this was a movie in regards to that scene. So Terry, you've got the next question.
All right. So I am right now in the middle of cover design of my third book. So my question to you is, how have your experiences been with things like cover design, editing, and publishing? And is there anything that you would do differently if you had to do it over again?
Oh, interesting. So I went to Regi Discovery to get editors. And again, as I said, I had this kind of friend, more like an acquaintance in North Carolina, had started in on it. So I knew what I did not want to happen. So I hired this young lady to do the two books, and she seemed reasonably strong. She wasn't trying to rewrite anything. She was eventually just doing line editing and proofreading. And I was very comfortable with that. The cover design, the other book that I wrote, the political one, the fellow who edited that had interesting covers. So I went to the designer that he had through Fiverr, a young lady in Eastern Europe, as a matter of fact. And she kind of overlays images. So she asked me to pick out what I thought. So I picked out an image of the mountain and the sky and the individual standing there in his sort of long leather wraps, because it's at night. And she overlaid it and then did the lighting and the color. And then we did a similar image on the next book, but it's the next book is a little different, because Thunder Rock is both a person and a cave that explodes from a lightning strike in the middle of a storm. So I was comfortable with that. I also hired, through Fiverr, people to do layout. I was very comfortable with them. The one guy that I think I used, if I remember correctly, was in Pakistan. And I also had to hire a guy to do maps. And that was a little slower. I thought he could have been dressed the maps up a little bit. But he did an accurate job, and it wasn't terribly expensive. I mean, a cover for my book is $50 to $75, okay? The maps were a little bit more. The editing is, I mean, the book layout is not much more for both Kindle and soft cover, you know, paperback. The process on the other side, different genre. I hired a guy through Writer's Digest, and I thought he was terrible. He was not helpful on a lot of things. Although I had a lot of mistakes, so he probably got tired of fixing them. And then went to a different editor who now just did my second book, who's, I think, very professional. He's a good writer himself. And his background on the political side, he knew military, he knew press, he knew some of the things which are helpful to me as a writer. So he did a little bit more. Whereas the young lady that did the Indian books really didn't edit, and she just did straightforward the proofing and line editing, make sure the book was clean. That makes sense, Terry?
I think you lost Terry again. No, we lost
okay,
Terry
can,
again.
Hopefully she can hear me.
Yeah, we
may
lost
I ask
her.
You
but
about Tom, you were talking about some scenes that you like. What do you think of the scene where Dancing Crow, who's the little young messenger who comes back to the village when the Aponoma escape and they attack the village, and he goes to meet this older woman, this kind of grandma type, who makes moccasins for him. What did you think of that scene?
Yes, I did enjoy that. I did enjoy that. And those are probably scenes that probably you're not planning, if I get the gist of it, that they just sort of pop in there as you're writing, that just comes to you. Is that correct?
Yeah. He was awarded this courageous messenger title. And as part of that, they decide to give him a pair of, new moccasins that are like double thick so he can run between the villages and keep the two tribes allied, right, and all the local villages that they've begun to expand. And so I said to myself, well, where did those come from? And then this little movie starts. He goes to visit this lady who basically has very few teeth left, but she can work leather like nobody else can. And
yes,
she's just a sweet old lady, and her husband's died, and he holds her hand, and I'll be honest with you. There have been times when I've read that and I've cried, okay? That made
uh-huh.
me kind of silly, prideful, but that's what I wanted in that scene. I wanted
right.
that to be a very emotional, sentimental scene.
And that's how they did it. Am I correct, George, that they chewed the leather to make it softer?
Yeah. They might suffer with urine or some other kinds of stuff, but when they would, after it was all tanned and stuff, they literally chewed the leather to make it softer.
That is phenomenal. We only got about 7 minutes here, and we do have Terry back with us, but I got a couple of questions here. Do you think people in general read enough, George, and where do you see the future of books in, say, 50 years from now? Kind of a quick response, and then we'll get on to the last question.
I don't know who's out there. If it's Florida or Texas, they may not have any books in 50 years the way it's going, but that's a political statement.
Yeah,
I think that.
Yeah, it's true.
I just think it's funny that
I'm
you had to announce that that was a political statement
group
that just made me laugh.
Yeah.
In the writers group, there's one older gentleman in there who's a real MAGA Republican. He doesn't hide it. He's a great guy. One-on-one people are. And he made some comment. I said, well, geez, there's going to only be 4 books left in Florida by the end of the year. Anyway, so he took umbrage at that, but. I hope people read a lot. I've always read a fair amount. I'm not as consistent, say, as someone like yourself, Tom. I used to read, all the Tony Hillerman books, which are Indian of a different style, and, Lee Childs and a lot of that stuff. And I enjoy those sort of mysteries. But I don't read as much now, although, I read your book. I read people in my writers group. I read some stuff. I get free books from Amazon, so I always read at least one of those each month, continue to read. I think it's a way to escape a little bit. People got, myself included, sometimes locked in front of the TV, and they don't do enough to, whether it's nonfiction or fiction. I think fiction is just a great way to explore the world. It's
I
like
found
watching a travelogue.
Right. I've found it's become kind of an obsession with me that if I don't have a book or an addiction, possibly, if I don't have a book to read, I start to go stir crazy. And so I go out there and hunt for a book like Terry or you and just grab it, start going through the pages. And
well, we
that's,
appreciate
that's
it.
What
okay,
I do.
I'm glad you're out there doing it. we need a couple of million Tom Riddells.
Yeah, I read probably.
I agree, George.
I read about 50 books a year. I think I think it's right around 50 books a year right now. So anyway, George, we're losing time here, but this is your Oscar moment. Who would you like to thank out there? And any parting words for future authors that are out there listening tonight?
Well, particularly for the Indian books, my family at all levels was very patient with me on the whole subject. So that was great. And I've gotten encouragement because couple of my kids have did some proofreading for me and sort of storyline. And the people I like to thank the most are the beta readers that I almost can't do anything for. They're not all writers. Most of them aren't. And the people who just pick up the book and spend 7 to 10 hours reading it, come back with some meaningful comments, those people make my world go around. I couldn't write a book without them. They find so much stuff that's helpful.
That's great, George. And as we say in the Writer's Lounge and when we send out the request to potential authors to be interviewed on our show, I usually tell everybody that we make a lot of friends, and I consider you a friend, my friend, and we keep in touch off the air also, and I wish you much success. And how can people find you out there?
Well, in the books, there's the website. My personal website is kind of a long one, but it's O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, dot George, G-E-O-R-G-E, the number 6060@gmail.com, O'Brien.George60@gmail.com. And if somebody picks up one of the Indian books, they'd be able to see that. That's the easiest way to do it.
Very good indeed.
You know, I'm on Facebook and other stuff, so they can actually find my phone number if they want to go look for it.
Yeah, most people are nowadays, so that's a good thing. Well, George, thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge again here. We won't mention that other person that was on before, but we wish you success in the future with your future endeavors, and we'll be certain to pick up your future books. And I've always enjoyed reading your work. So have a good night, my friend, and we'll talk to you at another time.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Tom. I just feel lucky to be able to do this, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care now, George.
Bye-bye.
And there we go. And so, Terry, you're hopefully still with us here.
I don't know. Am I still here?
Yeah, you're still here.
Fantastic.
Yes, I can still hear you.
I can always still hear you. You just can't hear me, so I never know I'm missing until you say, Terry.
Right.
Terry.
Right. So I hope that cell problem gets fixed. Not that it interferes too much
crazy.
With the show.
This happens to me quite frequently lately, and so I think that it's – maybe there's just a cell tower that's having issues. I don't know. But I do want to thank you, Tom, because that's another person that I'm connected to. I'm beginning to really – like look forward to these shows to find that connection, to figure out how it is I'm going to be connected to this person.
Right.
It's really cool.
And honest, Terry, I don't set it up that way. It just happens. It really does. It really doesn't, you know, it's not something that I search around for. It just magically happens. So that's what makes the magic of the Writer's Lounge. And now that we've been on the air for 12 years, I think the magic is going to continue. You've been a wonderful co-host, and I want to remind everybody to tune in 2 weeks. We're going to let Terry slip off into the yonder here and remind everybody in 2 weeks that Chris Gould will be back on the show with his books, The Boys and Girls of America, Experience What It Was Like in the 1990s for a Writer to Return to a School as a Writer in Residence, even though he has refused entry when he was applied there in 1985. So until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and have a fabulous night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never the simple secret of the plot. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers as mine. you make.